The morning Rupert Mountfort dissolved his marriage, the great hall of Wexmoor Abbey was cold enough that Verity could see her own breath. Thin, white threads rising and disappearing in the gray autumn light that fell through the tall windows. She had stood in that hall for 9 years, receiving guests, directing servants, arranging the flowers that nobody commented on, and the accounts that nobody checked. And she stood in it now, with her hands still at her sides, while her husband spoke to her in the careful, rehearsed language of a man who had decided in advance that this conversation would not cost him anything. He told her the marriage would be dissolved. He told her she had not provided an heir. He told her he intended to remarry, that arrangements had been made for her comfort, that she would find the settlement generous. He spoke, and she listened. And the only sound besides his voice was the faint creak of the floorboards when he shifted his weight. And somewhere outside, the sound of wheels on cobblestones. Rupert watched her face the whole time he spoke. He watched it the way a man watches a window in a storm, expecting the glass to break. He had prepared, she understood, for tears. He had prepared for pleading, for the trembling lip and the outstretched hand, for the particular theater of a woman undone. He had his response to that theater already rehearsed. Steady, not unkind, firm in the way that powerful men are firm when they have decided that their firmness is a form of mercy. He watched her face, and Verity gave him none of it. "I thank you," she said, "for the years." Her voice was level, not cold. She was not cold, had never been cold, though she knew some in his circle had called her so. "I have one question. What is to happen to Flora?" That was when his composure cracked, not visibly, not in a way that anyone at a distance would have caught. But Verity had spent 9 years learning the small grammar of Rupert Mountfort's face, and she saw it. The fractional loss of footing, the slight widening behind the eyes, as if the floor had shifted an inch beneath him and he was recalibrating. He had not expected Flora's name to be the first thing out of her mouth. He had not expected her to be the first one to ask about the child. "Flora will remain at Wexmoor," he said. "She is my ward." "She is 4 years old," Verity said, "and she has known no other mother. I would ask that you consider what suits her, not only what is legally convenient." She did not press it further. She did not raise her voice. She turned and walked to the tall window that looked down over the cobbled patio at the front of the house, and looked out and stopped. Below, in the gray morning light, the Dowager Duchess Honoria's traveling carriage stood waiting on the cobblestones. The horses were still, the coachman already on the box, and through the carriage window, Verity could see two figures on the seat. Honoria herself, upright and composed, her silver hair visible beneath the brim of her hat. And beside her, wrapped in a heavy traveling rug and clutching a small cloth rabbit to her chest, was Flora, the Duke's own mother. Come not to comfort her son. Come to carry his wife away. Verity stood at the window for a moment and let herself feel the full weight of what she was seeing. The woman who had given Rupert his name and his rank sitting in a carriage in his own patio, having already collected the child, already waiting, already decided. She did not look at Rupert. She did not need to. She crossed the hall to the door, and she walked out of Wexmoor Abbey under her own feet. And she did not look back. Rupert stood alone in the hall and listened to the sound of the carriage wheels moving away across the cobblestones. And for a long moment, he did not move at all. The carriage ride to Heatherton took the better part of 3 hours, and Honoria spent the first of them in silence, which was itself a form of speech. Flora fell asleep against Verity's arm before they had cleared the Abbey's grounds. The cloth rabbit still pressed to her chest, and Verity sat with the child's weight warm against her side and looked out at the gray fields moving past the window. It was Honoria who spoke first. She did not soften what she had to say with preamble. "I will not return you to a son who has become this," Honoria said. "I want that stated plainly, so there is no misunderstanding between us. Grantley House is yours for as long as you want it. I have already written to the solicitor." "You did not have to do this," Verity said. "I did," Honoria said, "and I want no argument about it. You have given 9 years to that house. You have given more than 9 years' worth, and Rupert knows it, even if he has chosen not to admit it yet. Grantley is not charity. It is what is owed." Verity looked down at Flora's sleeping face, the small nose, the dark lashes fanned against her cheek. "He said she would remain at Wexmoor." "She is in this carriage," Honoria said, and something in her voice closed the subject. Grantley House stood on the southern edge of Heatherton, a solid stone building with a walled garden and a kitchen that smelled of wood smoke and old plaster. It was not Wexmoor. It was smaller, quieter, and warmer in ways that had nothing to do with the fireplaces. Within a day of their arrival, Verity had found the linen cupboard, assessed the kitchen garden, and made Flora a bed in the room with the south-facing window. On the fourth day, she walked up Heatherton's High Street and stood in front of a narrow building with a low sign above the door and a padlock on the latch. Her father's dispensary. He had been dead 3 years, and the building had sat locked since his death, the landlord uncertain what to do with a space that smelled of dried herbs and old timber, and the particular quiet of a room where people had once been helped. She obtained the key from the landlord that same afternoon. She was back the following morning with a bucket and a brush. Within a fortnight, the dispensary was open. The shelves were clean. The glass jars were arranged by use, not by size, the way her father had always kept them. Verity worked the mortar her father had left behind, a heavy, dark-stained thing that she had watched his hands use since she was old enough to stand on a stool. And the village found its way to her door with the particular speed that villages reserve for things they have needed and not had. She did not wait to be sought out. She did not perform recovery. She worked, and the work was real. And that was enough for now. Wexmoor Abbey in early autumn was a house that had forgotten what it was for. The household accounts, which Verity had managed with a thoroughness so quiet that nobody had ever thought to notice it, began to fall into error within the first 2 weeks. An order to the chandler was doubled. A quarterly payment to the groundskeeper was missed. The kitchen register showed purchases that did not match the meals that were being served. The steward, who had always brought the accounts to Verity on Thursdays, brought them to Rupert instead. And Rupert spent an unpleasant hour each week discovering that the numbers did not resolve the way they had always resolved, and that he did not know why. Flora refused her meals. She sat at the nursery table and ate nothing, or ate only bread. And at bedtime she asked for Verity by name, not for her nurse, not for her uncle, but for Verity, repeatedly, with the patient, bewildering persistence of a 4-year-old who does not understand why the answer keeps being no. The social calls that Verity had maintained, the invitations answered, the morning visits returned, the small, careful commerce of county society that keeps a great house connected to its neighbors, stopped arriving. Not all at once, and not with any drama. They simply thinned, the way water thins when a source is removed, until the hall that had once seen visitors twice a week stood quiet. Rupert came to Grantley House on the 12th day. He arrived with no announcement, which was itself an act of presumption, and Verity received him in the front room. She was standing when he entered, and she remained standing, which meant he could not comfortably sit. And she did not offer tea, which meant the visit had no social architecture to support it. "You are well?" he said. "I am," she said. Is there something specific you needed to say? He had not, it became clear, prepared anything specific. He had come, she thought, with the vague intention of finding her diminished, a little worn, a little grateful for the visit, and instead found her standing in a room that already felt more organized than the rooms he had left behind. He left after 20 minutes, having said nothing of substance, and she stood at the window and watched the carriage pull away. He came a second time, 11 days later. She received him the same way, standing, front room, no tea. He got further this time. He mentioned Flora, mentioned that the child was asking for her. And Verity's expression shifted slightly, a narrowing of attention that was not softness, but was something adjacent to it. I would like to visit her, Verity said, if you will permit it. She is here, Rupert said, and something moved across his face that was not quite triumph and not quite relief. I brought her. She is in the carriage. Then please send her in, Verity said, and her voice was warm and immediate in a way it had not been for him at all. And Rupert heard the difference and said nothing. Lady Carstairs came to Wexmoor during this same period, twice, and on her second visit she stayed for dinner and spoke at length about the advantages of a swift and clean resolution. Her daughter Sybil was accomplished, well-connected, and young enough that the question of an heir remained open. The delay, Lady Carstairs argued, was damaging to everyone. Every week that the dissolution remained unannounced was a week of uncertainty, and uncertainty was the one thing a dukedom could not afford. Rupert listened to her and agreed with more of it than he examined, and told himself that the unease he felt on the drive home was simply the ordinary discomfort of transition. He arrived at the dispensary without warning on a Tuesday, which was market morning in Heatherton, and the street outside was busy with carts and voices and the smell of wood smoke and livestock. Inside, the dispensary was quiet by contrast. A low, warm room with shelves on three walls and the smell of dried lavender and something sharper underneath it. A medicinal note that Rupert associated, distantly, with illness and care. Verity was on the upper step of the wooden stool, restocking the high shelf with a row of brown glass bottles. She heard him come in, turned her head to acknowledge him, and turned back to the shelf. I have not finished this row, she said. You may wait, or you may go. He waited. He stood near the door with his hat in his hands and watched her work. And she worked without hurrying and without performing. And the quiet between them was not comfortable, but it was not hostile either. It was the silence of a woman who had stopped requiring anything of a particular man. She came down from the stool and moved to the counter to record the restocking in the account book. And as she reached past him for the pen, the lower drawer of the glass cabinet caught on its runner and slid free. A dozen small bottles shifting toward the edge, the whole drawer pitching forward. Rupert's hand came out without thought, catching the drawer's edge against the counter, bracing it there, and Verity's hand arrived at the same moment from the other side. And for a moment their hands were both on the wood, separated by nothing but the width of the drawer's edge. Neither of them moved. Neither of them spoke about it. After a moment, Verity steadied the drawer and slid it back into the cabinet, and Rupert straightened and said nothing, and the moment was gone. But not gone, because it sat in the room with them for the rest of the visit, unnamed and unmistakable. He came a third time, 2 weeks after that, and this time he had prepared. He began to speak almost before he was through the door. An apology, or the architecture of one, the kind of speech that a man constructs when he has rehearsed it enough that it sounds like feeling but moves like argument. He reached across the counter and took her hand to keep her from turning away, and the words kept coming. Verity looked down at his hand on hers. Then she withdrew her hand, slowly, with full intention, without hurry, and walked back to the weighing scales on the far end of the counter and set a small measure of dried root onto the pan. "I heard you," she said, not unkindly. "You may go." He left. She did not watch him go. She listened to the bell above the door, and then to the stillness that settled back into the room. And she stood at the scales for a long moment before she wrote the weight in the book. Honoria sent for Dr. Greaves on a Wednesday in mid-October, and she did not tell Verity in advance. Verity came home from the dispensary in the late afternoon to find the dowager in the sitting room with a small, white-haired man in a dark coat who stood when she entered and did not sit again until she did. "Dr. Greaves attended Rupert 9 years ago," Honoria said. "During the fever, I have asked him to come because there is something you should hear from him directly. And I want you to hear it in this room, and not from anyone else." Verity looked at the doctor. "Say it then," she said. Greaves was a careful man, and he chose his words with the precision of someone who had rehearsed them and still found them difficult. He told her that in the winter of the year before her marriage, Rupert had contracted a severe fever, a prolonged illness of nearly 3 weeks that had left him weakened for months afterward. He told her that in the course of examining Rupert during his recovery, he had formed a clinical opinion, and that he had communicated that opinion to Rupert privately, and that Rupert had received the information and understood it clearly. The opinion was this: that the illness had left Rupert incapable of fathering children, that this had been known to Rupert before the marriage, that it had been known to Rupert before the dissolution proceedings began. Verity sat with this for a moment. The fire in the grate made a small sound. Outside the window, the garden was going dark. "He told you," she said, "before we were married." Greaves answered her directly, "Yes." "And he proceeded with the marriage?" Greaves held her gaze. "Yes." "And he has known throughout 9 years that the absence of an heir was not a failure of mine." "He has known since before you were his wife," Greaves said. He did not look away from her face, which she respected. 9 years. She had carried the weight of it for 9 years, the unspoken accusation, the pity in the faces of women who had children and looked at her as though she were a room with something missing in it. She had sat through dinners where Lady Carstairs spoke about the importance of succession as though Verity were not present, or as though her presence were itself the argument. She had watched Rupert accept the sympathy of men who called it a great shame. His situation, a great shame. And he had accepted it with the gravity of a man who has suffered. And all the while, he had known, and he had given her the weight of it, and worn the grief of it himself like a borrowed coat. And she had protected his right to wear it. She sat very still. "I will not use this to destroy him," she said at last. She said it to Honoria, not to the doctor. Honoria looked at her for a long moment. "I know," she said. "I did not bring him here to give you a weapon. I brought him here so that you would know you are not alone in the truth." Verity nodded once. She thanked the doctor. She did not cry until she was in her room, and then only briefly, and for the child she had not had and the years she could not recover, and not for Rupert at all. Flora's fever came without warning on a Thursday night in late October. By Friday morning, it was high enough that the child was delirious, calling for people who were not in the room and pushing away the blankets, and then shivering when they were removed. Honoria sent a rider to Wexmoor before noon. Verity had already begun. She moved through the sick room with the steady efficiency of someone who had watched her father work. Compresses changed on a regular interval. A tisana prepared from the dispensary stores, the window cracked an inch for air, and then closed again when the temperature dipped. She held Flora's hand through the worst of it, the hours when the child's small face was flushed and damp, and her breathing was too fast. And she spoke to her in a low, continuous voice, even when Flora could not hear her. Because the voice was not for Flora's understanding, but for Flora's body, which needed to know that someone was there. Rupert arrived that night, after dark, still in his traveling coat. He came through the door of the sick room and stopped when he saw Verity at the bedside. And something moved across his face that was not the polished concern of a man performing the appropriate response. It was simpler than that, and worse. It was fear, the plain animal fear of a man who has walked into a room and understood that something he loves might not be in it much longer. "Tell me what to do," he said. Verity looked at him. She considered, for a brief moment, the distance she had maintained and the reasons for it. Then she nodded at the basin on the stand beside the door. "Empty that," she said. "Bring fresh water from the kitchen. The cloths need to be wrung out and laid again every quarter hour." He did it. He did it badly. He wrung the cloths with too much force and then too little. And the fresh water he brought was slightly too warm the first time, and he had to go back. He did not complain about any of it. He did not ask to be instructed more gently. He simply did the work again, and then again. And when Flora's head needed to be lifted so Verity could administer the medicine, he was there to hold it, his large hands careful and uncertain at the same time, learning a thing his body had never been asked to learn. There were no servants in the room. There was no ceremony possible. There was only the lamp and the child and the sound of her breathing and the two people on either side of the bed doing the only work that mattered. Verity watched him across the bed in the low light, not studying him, not assessing him, but simply seeing him clearly in the way that exhaustion strips away the interpretive layers and leaves only what is actually there. She saw a man who was frightened and working through the fear with his hands. She saw someone who had no elegance in this room, no rank, no rehearsed response, and who had not left. She saw, for the first time in 9 years, perhaps for the first time ever, not the Duke of Wexmore, but the man underneath the title. And the man was frightened and willing to be awkward about it. And she did not know yet what to do with that. But she did not look away. The fever broke at dawn. It broke the way fevers break, not with any drama, but with a sudden stillness in the child's face, a deepening of the breathing, the color shifting from that dangerous high flush to something more ordinary. Flora opened her eyes, said Verity's name in a small, clear voice, and went back to sleep. Rupert was still in the chair beside the bed. His coat was across the back of the chair. He had not shaved. His head had tipped sideways in sleep, and his hand rested near Flora's on the coverlet, close but not touching. Verity looked at him for a long moment. Then she went downstairs and made tea and sat at the kitchen table in the gray morning light and allowed herself to feel the relief of the night being over. Flora recovered over the following days, returning to herself in stages. First the appetite, then the voice, then the particular quality of her attention that meant she was watching everything and storing it away. She asked Rupert why his coat was on the chair, and he told her he had been cold, which was not the truth, but was the kind of lie that children accept, because the real answer is too large for the question. The village had noticed Rupert's extended presence at Grantley House. Villages always notice, and the village, having noticed, spoke. And what it spoke about eventually reached the circles that mattered, and then the circles beyond those. Doctor, Greaves was not a man who sought gossip, but he was a man who had kept a difficult silence for 9 years. And the sight of Rupert Mountfort sitting in the sick room of the woman he had divorced loosened something in him that had been held tight for a long time. He spoke first to his wife. His wife spoke to the rector's wife. The rector's wife spoke to Lady Ashworth, who was Honoria's oldest friend. And from Lady Ashworth, the account moved with a particular velocity of information that people have been waiting for permission to believe. Lady Carstairs's campaign for the Sybil engagement collapsed publicly and with considerable noise. She had arranged a drawing-room gathering specifically to advance the formal announcement. And it was in that drawing-room that someone, no one ever confirmed who, raised the question of the heir's origin, not unkindly, but directly. If the Duke was dissolving one marriage for failing to produce an heir, and the physician who attended him 9 years ago was now speaking openly about the nature of his illness, then the question of whose failure it had been seemed suddenly relevant. Lady Carstairs attempted to redirect the conversation twice and failed both times, and left the gathering before it concluded, taking Sybil with her. Rupert came to Grantley House 3 days after this. He arrived in the late afternoon, and Verity received him in the sitting room. And this time she was seated when he entered, which was a different geometry than before. And he stood near the window and looked at her with an expression she had not seen on him in years. Not the composed, managed look of a man conducting his affairs, but something raw and without its usual covering. "You knew," he said, "before the dissolution. You knew what Greaves told me." "Yes," Verity said. "How long?" "The third year of our marriage," she said. "I found the letter from Greaves in your study. I was looking for the household accounts, and I found it by accident. And I read it. And I put it back." "And you said nothing?" She met his eyes steadily. "No." He looked at her for a long moment. "Why?" Verity set down the book she had been holding. "Because that year had already cost you a great deal," she said. "Your father had died. The estate was in difficulty. You were carrying more than you could comfortably carry. And I did not think that adding the loss of your dignity to the rest of it would help you or help us." She paused. "I was wrong, perhaps. But that was my reasoning." He turned away from her and stood facing the window for a long time without speaking. Outside, the garden was dark, and the glass gave back only the reflection of the lamp. "I am going to destroy you with this," he said at last. Not a threat, a statement directed at himself. "You are not going to destroy me," Verity said. "I am already standing on the other side of it." He left without responding, and she sat in the quiet room and listened to the gate close. And then she went to the dispensary alone. And she opened the account book on the workbench, and she turned to a fresh page, and at the top of it, she wrote her name. Not her married name. Her own name. Fenwick. She looked at it for a moment in the lamplight. And then she closed the book and went home. Rupert summoned the company to Wexmoor on a Friday in November. They came expecting an announcement. Lady Carstairs had not been invited, but the news of the gathering had reached her through the usual channels, and she had reason to believe, had been given reason to believe, that the evening would conclude with the formal declaration of his engagement to Sybil. She came anyway, with Sybil beside her, and was not turned away at the door, because Rupert had made no instruction to turn her away. The company assembled in the long drawing room. Perhaps 30 people, the inner county circle, the men who knew his father and the women who had watched his marriage with the careful attention that society reserves for arrangements it finds instructive. They stood with their glasses and their conversations and their particular quality of alert social readiness, the readiness of people who have been brought to a room to witness something and are prepared to witness it. Rupert came in without preamble and stood before them. And the room went quiet with the speed that rooms go quiet when the person they have been waiting for has arrived and is not performing the expected approach. He did not thank them for coming. He did not make any of the social preparations that his rank had trained him to make. He stood before them, and he spoke, and what he said was this: I have brought you here because you deserve to hear this from me directly, and not in the form in which it has been circulating. The dissolution of my marriage to Verity Fenwick was sought on the grounds that she had not provided an heir. That was the stated reason. It was not the true reason, because the true reason is this: the failure was mine. A fever, 9 years ago, left me unable to father children. I knew this before the marriage. I have known it throughout the marriage. My wife knew it also, and chose silence to protect me from it. And I repaid that silence by making her the cause of my own deficiency before every person in this county. The room was very still. I pursued the dissolution, Rupert continued, to bury a fact I did not have the courage to own. In doing so, I discarded the only person who knew the truth and had chosen, out of loyalty I did not deserve, to keep it. He paused. The dissolution is withdrawn. The succession to the dukedom passes as it must, through whatever line the family provides. I have no clean male heir, and I will not obtain one. That is the consequence of what I did and what I was, and I accept it. He said nothing further about Verity. He did not name her as present or absent. He did not ask anything of anyone in the room. He stood before them with the cost of the speech visible on his face, the loss of the careful, managed composure that had served him for 49 years, and let them see him without it. Lady Carstairs left. She did not speak as she went. Sybil followed her, and the sound of their departure was the only sound in the room for a moment after the door closed. Then someone, an older man near the fireplace, a man who had known Rupert's father, set down his glass and said, very quietly, "Well." Rupert walked out. He did not wait for a response, did not stay for the conversation that would follow, did not manage the aftermath. He walked through the hall and out the front door of Wexmoor Abbey and down the steps to the drive, and he kept walking. He took the carriage as far as the edge of Heatherton and then sent it back. The last miles he walked on foot, in the November evening, along the lane that ran from the main road to the village, with the hedgerows dark on either side, and the sky above them a deep, fading blue. He carried nothing. He had sent no word ahead. He arrived at the gate of Grantley House in the early evening with mud on his boots and his coat still damp from the evening air, and he stood at the gate for a moment before he opened it. Verity opened the front gate herself. She had seen him coming up the lane from the sitting room window, had stood at the glass and watched him approach on foot, without a carriage behind him, without servants, without any of the apparatus of his rank. And she had come to the door, and then to the gate. And she stood now on her own path, in her own garden, and looked at him. "I know what you did today," she said. "Word came before you did." "I did not do it to compel anything from you," Rupert said. "I want that stated before I say anything else. I am not here to collect a debt." "Then say what you came to say," she said. He was quiet for a moment. When he spoke, it was without the polished syntax of his rank, haltingly searching for words with the particular difficulty of a man who has never had to find them before, who has always had language arrive ready-made and has never needed to reach for it. "I was wrong," he said. "Not in one thing, in every direction. I married you, and I reduced you to a function, and when the function failed, I told myself it was your failure and not mine. And I told myself that often enough that I believed it, and I made you carry it. And the thing I cannot... He stopped. He began again. You knew. You knew the whole time, and you said nothing, and I did not ask myself why. I did not ask myself what kind of person chooses to carry a weight for someone who never thanked her for it. I did not ask because the answer would have required me to see you, and I did not want to see you, because seeing you clearly meant seeing myself the same way. Verity listened to him finish. The garden was quiet around them, the last light going out of the sky above the roof line. Then she crossed the distance between them and kissed him. Not urgently, steadily, with the calm of a woman who has decided something and is acting on the decision. She held it for a moment, and then she pulled back, and she looked at him. And his hands had come up slightly at his sides and then stopped there, because he had not pressed the moment further, had not moved toward her or away from her, had simply received what she offered and waited. I am not forgiving you, she said. Not tonight, and not as a gift. Forgiveness is something I will decide about over time, on my own terms. He answered without hesitation. I understand. This is my life, Verity said. I built it without you. The dispensary, this house, the work I do here. None of it was built towards you. I am not going to unmake it because you have finally become someone worth letting in. She paused. But you may share it, as a guest of the woman I am now. Not the woman I was at Wexmoor, not the woman you married, this one. And if you cannot accept those terms, then tonight ends here, at this gate. Rupert looked at her for a long moment. I accept them, he said. He said it simply, without elaboration. And she believed him precisely because he did not dress it up. She opened the back door into the house, and the warm light of the kitchen fell out across the garden path. And from somewhere upstairs came the faint sound of Flora's voice, the child calling something cheerful to no one in particular, the ordinary sound of a child in a house where she felt safe. They went inside. The fire in the grate burned low through the evening. A lamp was lit on the table, and later it was not. The clock on the mantel marked the hours in the dark, and the house was quiet around them. The following morning, Flora's voice came down the staircase before the light was fully up, a running commentary on the state of her rabbit, on the question of breakfast, on whether the frost on the window counted as snow. In the kitchen, the mortars were already warm from the fire, and the smell of dried herbs and wood smoke moved through the rooms the way it always did. The smell of the house, as it had become. On the workbench beside the window, the account book lay open to the page she had turned to the week before, the fresh page with its single line of inscription at the top, the name she had written in her own hand, the name she had carried before Wexmoor and carried still, Fenwick. The sun came through the window and fell across the open page, and the morning began.